I received four notes today on the board. Two and two. Two people wanted to know about the mantra and that I repeat the words and that I, you know, explain it a little bit maybe. And two people said, can you please talk about death? How to become more familiar with my own death and dying and the fear of that. The two go well together. But I want to start a little bit differently. And to start, I will come to those questions. I've read them, I've heard them, they will be answered. No, maybe never answered, but I will try my best. When living this life of a Dharma teacher, with, you know, called Lama, but since I'm also a medical doctor and involved in therapy and so on, then many people come to me with suffering. Many. It's been my life. Yes, it's been, that's already as a Buddhist monk. I was a Buddhist monk for 21 years. I was not only guiding the retreats, but I was the resident doctor of the monastery with its 250 people, you know, 60 volunteers among them, and many visitors from the outside. So I saw many, many people, and I accompanied many people when dying also, when in terminal illness. I remember this young man with five children dying of brain cancer, you know, situations like that, you don't want to live them actually. But they happen all the time, and you probably have lived that as well. You have lived many difficult situations. And the one question that is always, what is compassion in such situations? And am I allowed to be happy when others suffer? Or when there is so much suffering around? Am I allowed to be happy when I'm sitting at the bed of someone in the process of leaving this world? What is my role when I come to visit a family, like I visited this family afterwards? I talked with the five children who had just lost their father. And I came to a very clear answer. Very clear. And this is what I want to share with you. It is almost my duty to be happy. I can be of most service when people are in distress, when I myself keep a free mind. When I find ways to be in touch with my joy, with my happiness, without, you know, not going into this overboarding happiness, come on, the world is nice and so on, you know, here, you know, paint it all in pink and it will be better. No, 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 not this. It is the sensitive joy, the sensitive happiness. It is this joy you carry deep inside and which nourishes you and which nourishes me and which gives me the strength to go through difficult situations. I don't despair. So I can read a little bit in your faces that, you know, it doesn't need much, that you have gone through difficult times, everybody, everywhere. And yes, and then I can imagine that some of you somehow don't even dare to be happy. That it is just almost forbidden to be joyful. And actually, when I received these instructions from my teacher, Genyo Rinpoche, he said, you have one job as a Lama, one job. Every day, to contact the source of blessings, the source of true happiness. That's my job. So wherever I am, whatever the challenges are, whatever I do in my life, accompanying those with, of course, lots of emotional problems. That's what they seek me out for. Lots of Dharma questions, but lot of illness and dying and so on. Distress. Yeah, that's when you go and see a spiritual guide. Yes. And then my job is not how I answer, how I deal with that. My job is, and I understood why my teacher said it to me, my job is to be deep inside, to be connected, to be connected to the source. You know, this is what I wish that you have the courage to do. So that the moment you feel there is an opening, you can go along and it can all become lighter for those moments which you share with others. And then there is moments to be serious again. Then there are moments to cry together. Yes, to share sorrow. And then again, there is this lightness because we are still connected to the source. So basically what I will share with you this week is again and again, in many different ways, connecting to the source. And this is the real meaning of religion, you know, to connect us back with that which is actually the most inspiring. We would call it the refuge. Yeah, this is to always be in the refuge at least one moment per day. I call it my moment of touchdown. Yes? So I've translated it in these, like in football, when you go for the touchdown, you know, in American football, you know, this is the idea, okay, touch ground. All the practice, whatever I practice, my morning practice, I usually, the aim of my morning practice is not to attain nirvana, it's to have my daily touchdown. Yeah, that's the, okay, and then how to get there is how to be able to relax with the present problems. I'm also the CEO of a non-profit organization which has lots of construction work to do and so on. There's lots of challenges. I had to renew my whole team and so on. Lots of challenges, you know, the usual ones, like you have all the time. And there would always be a chance, you know, there's enough opportunity to get worried. There's enough opportunity to think this world is a bad place. And there's enough stuff to say, I'm fed up. Come on. Bodhisattva in this world, that was a bad decision. No, no. I take that back. No. But now it doesn't happen for as long as I'm able to experience this touchdown. You know, touching down into the source. Ah, that's it. That is a daily reminder. It's not a reminder coming through the intellect. It's a reminder of what we are here for, coming from experience. Now, my whole meditation teaching is all about that. Just kind of taking you with me somehow for those touchdowns. And that's why I like to do these guided meditations, you know, how to be connected. And I do exactly with my own mind what I teach to you, what I share with you. I don't do something else. I'm very bad in teaching things which I don't do myself. These kind of methods, structures, I've taught them all at the time when I was still using them. I can teach you, you know, the way of doing normal shamatha practice and so on. But I will immediately slide over in doing Mahamudra shamatha because that's what I do. I can tell you how to meditate on a visual object. Yes, we can maybe do that together. It's fun. But of course, I will begin then teaching to you, oh, yeah, look at the object. But maybe you can look through the object. Maybe the object and the space, you know, in between the rosemary and so on. The space between the flowers can be more inspiring than the flowers themselves. You know, just relate to space and relate to the object. So this would be a little bit different way than the usual way of meditating shamatha. It would be the Mahamudra way of relating to situations. So when I hear sorrow, when I hear big pain, yes, I go along with that, but I'm not caught in it. You understand? Because I've learned to experience the space at the same time. When things go wrong, there's always space around that which is going wrong. You know? A flat tire in the middle of the sun heat, you know, is something really going wrong when you want to go somewhere. But it's just this minor, a little example. But why make it into the central thing to get upset? And now you can enlarge this to the bigger things of your life. And death also is one of those little things which we make big. Everyone has managed to die so far. It's no exception. Dying doesn't seem to be the difficult thing. It's the suffering before and the unknown afterwards. The actual moment of dying is more like actually then after saying goodbye to actually leave. You know, the saying goodbye is maybe difficult, but the moment you are decided and you let go, it's just like closing the car door and drive. You know? Go on, and you need to do the next touchdown. Because what's left to do when we die? Dissolution process, what will happen? We go for a touchdown. Right? We go into the source. And if we know how to do that, and we have done it all our life, then leaving this body will not be so difficult. We just go for another meditation. And when we come back on the other side, we continue to meditate. We just do it, because we have done it all our life. Sounds simple, huh? Sounds almost too simple to believe. But it works. And when with this confidence and this lightness I can sit at the bed of someone just dying and we can share the Dharma like this, of course it helps. Why should I be in distress just because someone is going for the next session of meditation? You know? It doesn't make sense. We have to accept. We have to accept. Yes, you have 5 children. Yes, and we try to see that they are well taken care of. Yes, and of course you have to say goodbye. All of this could be heartbreaking. But there's also all the love you share, there's all the wonderful things you can appreciate. Hey, there is space to see more of just the focus of suffering. There's always more. And this is the basic teaching of Mahamudra. We could call it, it's to open up to a panoramic perspective. We don't only have this place. We don't only have this country. We don't only have the Middle East. We have a whole planet. And even the planet is not the only thing. Large, go wide, go wide. What is the inner planet, you know, of your mind? Which planet you want to live on? Which planet you want to give your energy to? Hey, there is space. Now, when people are suffering, and this is the problem already, when the Buddha described suffering, we described dukkha, he described this narrowing down. And that is dukkha. This means there is clinging. Clinging means there is a narrowing. The spaciousness gets lost. When there is insight into the ungraspable nature, the changing, the impermanent nature, then there's a letting go of the grasping and the space opens. Yeah? We become fluid again. And actually, these are moments of touchdown. Yeah? Some of them prepare the actual touchdown, and the others, they are that completely open experience. Now, this is something I would like to share with you to really to give yourself the encouragement to find into a lightness, you know, light in the sense of not heavy in this sense, a lightness, a fluidity. You might call it joy and happiness, but it's more about this flexibility, fluidity, lightness in times of distress. That's exactly what is needed. As kind of as Dharma practitioners, it's very important that, yes, we say yes to the suffering. Yes, we don't fight it. And we don't indulge in it. In the now, we always have a second option. We have more than two options. But basically, we have the option to cling and not to cling. So, yes, terror happens on earth. Yes. And do you want to stay with that? No. No, no, no. Love also happens on earth. You want to stay with that? No. Go further. Never stay with just one perspective. Always remain open and connected to that what we call the source, the actual refuge. And this refuge is called Bodhi. Huh? This is like awakening. This is like where all our qualities awaken. Okay. And that's what we need to do in life and in dying. And the Buddhist tradition claims that there is no death. It just doesn't exist. There's no death. There's only continuity. So if you want me to prepare you for death, I can only prepare you for continuity. There's no way to prepare you for death. Death is too easy. There's no need to prepare for that. We can prepare for leaving our beloved ones. We can prepare for separation. We can prepare for entering new grounds, like going to a new country. Like for me, coming into Israel now, coming into a new country, should I read lots of books about it? Should I get informed about the pro and cons of different opinions on the politics and the war and so on? No. Oh, how do I go? It's like leaving one place and entering a new. And what will serve me? Only my awareness. It's being there, being aware. Moving into the new situations, not so many a priori, you know, these kind of formed opinions by listening to others, but actually trusting that, you know, in German we say, if the heart is in the right spot, then you can manage all situations. Could that work for you? Something similar in your own culture? If you're really connected with your heart, and that is for me this heartfelt wisdom, this awareness, it's not a wisdom of knowledge, it's just a presence, a fluidity, and a willingness to respond. So with that, I mean, we can go everywhere. With this body, or with another one, or without body. Whatever happens in the bardo, in the intermediate state, you know, we might live lots of that without body. And we need to be prepared for quickly changing situations. And the best thing for that is fluidity. That's the best thing. Trying to hold on to opinions in the bardo is really stressful. You know, in the bardo, in the intermediate state after death, when we have left this body and the consciousness comes back to full awareness, then no one asks you your passport. You have no more identity. Who cares if you were a woman or a man? Who cares? There's no one there caring. You know, all these identities which we have, which we are so identified with, and they are so central to our existence now, they are meaningless afterwards. What counts is again how you perceive the world, how flexible you are, how open and how much grasping there is, because immediately the karmic cinema will project films to which you can grasp easily. The habitual patterns, they can project all kinds of films. Horror and heaven, everything is possible. Now, in both cases, the advice would be stay relaxed. Stay relaxed, stay connected. Stay connected to just being simple. Okay, so let's use these situations, and I'm the billions teacher saying that, yet let's use the now for a little bit of dying. Yes, let's use this moment of now to always let go a little bit of preoccupations, of identity. And that's exactly when the touchdown happens, when we're not someone in particular anymore. You know, the way we experience the nature of mind is not different from one culture to the next, from a man to a woman, from a child to the grandmother. It's not different. We're talking about the same experience. Okay, so this was a little answer to these questions. It won't take away the fear of dying, of death. Maybe it gives you the courage to face the fear. No. There is nothing you can lose when facing the fear. Go straight into it, and again, you will discover space. Okay, as an encouragement, I tell you a story of one of my retreat cooks. Okay, I was guiding these retreats where everyone came together, 15 people, 15 men. On the other side, there were the men, the women. 3 years, 3 months, 3 days, not leaving this courtyard with the 15 rooms around. Yeah. No garden, pretty much no garden, just very little bit of green. Only practice, from morning 5 o'clock to night 10, only practice, meditation practice. All these retreats, they had two cooks. And the cooks were usually those who felt, I'm not at ease with practicing full-time, I want to be a half-time practitioner, and I want to serve. So I had this wonderful guy called Jerome, tattoos all over, a really, you know, strong guy, French, and great cook. And since his childhood, every night nightmare, being persecuted, fear of dying, every night waking up, trembling, and it continued into the retreat. And he received this instruction, of course, to face the emotions, like I'm beginning to teach you, you know, to face, to enter the experience. And in the second year of retreat, pretty much in the middle of the whole retreat, then he told us, he came to me and said, I have to tell you something. There was a night a few weeks ago when I turned around in the nightmare. In the nightmare where normally I have been running since childhood, I turned around and I faced the fear, I faced the danger. And there was nothing there. Since that night, the nightmare never returned. We have kept contact for some 10 years. And then I lost contact. But just to tell you the power of when you really do it. So it won't help so much if I tell you, you know, it's easy to die and so on. All of this doesn't help when someone feels fear of dying. But the moment you will turn around, when it is the right time, you will do it. Then actually, then you can become fearless. It has happened to me as well. There was a moment in my life when I thought I will die. And I could see and could discover that fearlessness by looking into that fear. Fear of drowning. Yes. It works for all emotions. There's no exception. What we call an emotion, what is in technical terms a klesha, yeah, a klesha is an affliction, is something which narrows the mind. This is what I'm talking about, but this goes the same for the emotions which open the mind, like love and generosity. Whatever movement of the mind is present, when you look into it, nothing solid to be found. It was just movement. And because now the movement is one of interest, of looking into what was there before, that completely replaces all of what was there before. There's nothing left of the anger, of the pride, of the fear. There's nothing left. Because from the very beginning, they never had any substance. And this is really what the Dharma is working with. And that's why you can say Dharma practice thrives on emotions. You can say the more thoughts, the more movements we have, the more we have to look into. And the more our insight can grow. So we will get back to that. This is just to be more precisely answering the question about the fear of death. This I cannot do for you. You will have to look into it for yourself. I can only tell you that many have done it before you, and it was very relieving. I'm not saying that what comes after leaving this body is fine, you know, because this depends on our habitual tendencies. And then again, we have to look into them, you know, not to follow them, those ego-centered ones. Let's meditate a little bit. It's always a good thing to do. We continue like this morning. Remember, just one breath. And if your mind wants to do more mindful breath, you know, wants to continue being aware, breathing in, breathing out, then I invite you, after a few breaths, to tell to the mind, now is a pause. Please, don't try to go further. When we go with the sensations, the experience of the in-breath and the out-breath, this is called meditation with a focus, with a support. And when we say pause, then we do not focus anymore. We experience a stretch of just being without support. this instruction to make short sessions, only the duration of an in-breath or in-breath and an out-breath, is very much part of the Mahamudra tradition. It is, you can find it in all the commentaries. And it is an advice which you can use to solve that question of right effort. How much actually is needed? And actually, to come back into presence, only one mind movement is needed. Okay? You know that from the Vipassana teachings, you're very familiar with that probably. The moment you recognize that you are distracted, you're already back. Yeah? That's the mind movement. That is a very common instruction. Now, that is very true, and yet the effect is a little bit stronger if you come back with the help of the support. It's a little bit more than one mind movement. Breathing in, breathing out. It already stabilizes the mind in the experience, and if then you let go of focusing on the support, you have the after effect. You have the after effect of having been focused for a moment, having been out of distraction. And the mind likes that. It takes a little while, a second or two or ten, before it starts bubbling again. Yes? And it is this experience, how the mind is settled by itself, how it can be without having a focus, which we use in Mahamudra practice. It's the pause. You know, the so-called pause is the actual interesting part of the game. Because for as long as we are focusing, we are doing something with intention, and there's not a complete letting go. It's difficult to forget ourselves why we do something. So it's always the pause that offers the possibility to forget ourselves, to forget all intention. And then those who like coming from the pause, then you can play around with your mind and you start breathing in and breathing out as if it were still the pause. You know? You kind of keep that relaxation of the pause. To do whatever you want to do then. Breathing in is just one of the possibilities. So, it is like, if we were to say it in our professional life, we would say, okay, watch how you are when you are on vacation. And then when you go back to work, work as if you were on vacation. Well, doesn't it make sense? Oh, come on. I'm living my whole life like that. I'm working right now. You don't see it? Yes. I'm working. And it's very relaxed. So, the attitude is to, of course, we have to do things. And of course, I take care of a garden and I have so many things to do. I have a publishing house and so on, you know, so many things. But the attitude is to do it as if you were on vacation. And that's how you will never enter burnout, because you're not taking yourself so seriously. There is this atmosphere of forgetting yourself a little bit or a lot, not taking yourself so seriously while doing what you need to do. I hope that makes at some point sense to you, really, at some point. Of course, we hear our parents who always say, you can't be always on vacation, you know. Yes, yes, mom. But we also don't have to take life so serious all the time. We can tell mom that, you know, mom, is enough of that. We can be more light. Right? We can be a little bit less worried, less hope and fear, you know, a little bit less of that. And it will actually help us to even do a better job than before. We are so much better when we are relaxed. All our qualities, they come forth when we are relaxed. When we are tensed, you know, imagine I would be tense up here. I would be tense and trying to deliver a good talk. It wouldn't flow. I came with a completely different idea of what I was going to teach to you. If I had stuck to that idea, your experience and my presentation, they wouldn't have really met. I would, you know, you would adapt probably, you would accept the presentation and take whatever good you can take from it, but the meeting of minds, which I'm hoping to continue, would not happen if I stick to my procedure. I would have given a perfect outline of Mahamudra and so on, but this is not the spirit. Huh? You get what I mean? Yeah, it's the more important in life is to do things with quality. Whatever we do it with quality. You know, when we take care of a plant, we water it in the right place. And we say maybe hello to it. Yes, we do it with quality. When we bake a bread, we make a good bread, as good as we can. We're not, you know, if we are not stressed, we will have this love for beauty, we will have this love for the details, and we have the time for the details of whatever work we are doing. And then it will turn out good. It will turn out well. Whatever we are doing. Yes? And this is this attitude of the pause, the attitude of the pause entering the activity. We take the pause as an orientation of how to start the next activity. And because in the activity we tend to become too focused, we need the next pause. For some of you, it would be very easy, for example, to train and to go for 100 very mindful breathing cycles. And then you would go for 500. And you would also manage that. And it would give some peace to your mind. But then, the next activity you do, are you going to be that focused again? Are you not kind of carrying samsara over into your Dhamma practice and then from Dhamma practice back to your daily activity to make your Dhamma practice a success story like you wish to make your life a success story? This is not Dhamma practice. This is only counting breath. You can count sesame seeds if you want. It's a difficult thing to do, but you can try. Why is sesame seeds is because actually it's peanuts. Yeah, it's not what is giving enlightenment. It's only stabilizing the mind. For that it is good. Okay, but there's different ways of stabilizing the mind. Like doing a little bit of that. And then trusting the pause. Trusting this no effort, nobody doing anything. And when you get distracted in that, when that becomes the beginning of a new, you know, thought chain and so back to the simple focus, whatever focus you want to take. You can move through the body, on back to the body sensations elsewhere, you don't need to have the breath. Focus on a visual object, can do a mantra, all of that is possible. Do what is necessary and then trust the mind to stay in that openness, in the pause. And when you begin to observe what happens in the pause, then you can see, and this is an additional quality to mindfulness, it's we call it often conscientiousness, but it's just it's also called wakefulness. It's different terms are being used for that. In the pause, you can notice the stirring of your karmic impulses to engage with something. You can notice before you start thinking, you feel the impulse to think. The Buddha called this the thirst to think. You have heard about this? Tanya, yes, it's the thirst. The thirst to move into relationship with objects. And this thirst to think, we can relax that. And the best to relax it is in the pause, because nothing else is happening. It's easy to notice, you know, I'm sitting in meditation, and then I hear the sound, and then it's very easy to notice how I want to open the eyes and see what the sound is. Yes. And it's in the same way, I'm sitting, I'm focused. While I'm focused, I don't notice the wish to focus. I don't notice the wish to entertain a dualistic connection with the world. I don't notice that, because I'm actually doing it. When I stop, there is this unbearable openness. And help! I need an object. You know, it's like coming immediately. You know, it's like after a short while, for those who are not trained, comes the impulse to have the next thought, to focus on the next bird which is chirping, to whatever, feel the body, because we are getting uncomfortable being without a support, being without a focus, being without a dualistic relationship. This is the precursor, this thirst to think is the precursor of the fear to die. This is, you know, because this experience of being nobody in relation to nothing else is very close to dying. It is very close to the experience of having no more reference point. And it makes us uncomfortable. I haven't seen it in this group so much, but often when I go into deeper meditation practices and people start relaxing, when they really let go of control, and they meditate, they let go of control, and then suddenly comes a jerk. You know, it's a jerk in the middle of meditation. They don't know where it comes from. It is this control mechanism that wants to get back into a more structured connection with the world. Yeah, a more structured me. I'm losing myself, and this is making something deep inside afraid. They don't even notice the emotion, they only notice the jerk. Maybe you have had this already in your practice. I see at least one person was nodding, so second person was nodding, so that's very nice. Some of you can connect with that, because this is, so to speak, the self-defense, yeah, the self-defense of our dualistic world, yeah, or dualistic perception, by habit. And this is where we need to relax more. Not more deeper, but this area in where these impulses come that want to go back into the usual dualistic fixation. In that area where these impulses come, that's where meditation needs to stay. We need to stay a little bit there, becoming familiar with a degree of relaxation that normally would put us asleep. Normally we would fall asleep because we don't usually experience that degree of relaxation by being awake. You know, when we fall asleep, we have to give up all concern for whatever bothered us during the day. We have to go get out of self-concern. Otherwise, we can't sleep because it keeps on going. Now, to relax that, then usually we go through this wonderful nobody moment and then we touch sleep. Now, Mahamudra is to relax exactly like that, like we go to sleep, exactly that relaxation, and we relax into wakefulness, into complete presence, not into sleep. But the relaxation is the same. The non-identification is the same. And you can do it because you all have slept. At certain times in your life, you were all able to sleep. And hopefully even tonight. So you know how to do that. And now we have to work on that mechanism that relaxation means going to sleep. That's why so many of you get drowsy when we do these relaxed meditations. You wouldn't get so drowsy if we were doing effort-oriented meditations. If I give you tasks to do, well, some as a means of protection would also go drowsy, but the others, they would be able to do it and they would feel much more alive. You know, as soon as we have something to do, we have a task, we stay on the task, we can do it. Like those of you who, the moment you start reading at night, you know, if the book is interesting, you can go for hours. You don't sleep, you just stay. Yeah, some of you have learned to relax and fall asleep on the book. With the book, yes, but I'm of the type, when I get an interesting novel or something, then I will go until 4 o'clock in the morning or something. No, it stimulates the mind, and this is what we do with our thirst to think, as pause, relax, and this relaxation is uncomfortable if sleep is not following. If there's no sleep following, then this relaxation becomes a feeling of being disoriented, of not knowing who I am, whether I exist. That's why Descartes came up with this famous sentence, you know? You don't know the sentence? Cogito ergo sum, you understand, huh? It's like, I think, therefore, I exist. And this mechanism that he found out is not a proof for existence, it's just a proof for what is samsara. When I think, I feel that I exist. And this is exactly the mechanism we have to do with. That we move into thinking processes when we feel in danger, then there's a certain question arising whether I exist. And this is the existential fear. Yeah, this is the Buddha called this the undercurrent of samsara. One of the undercurrents is the wish to exist. Like it can shift when existence is not so nice, it can shift into wishing not to exist. And it is basically related to the wish to have sensory contact. Thinking is only one of the forms of sensory contact. Every sensory contact helps me to affirm my existence. Okay? So, you don't look on the clock. So you get now what we are doing in meditation, huh? Focus, pause, and in the pause, when you get used to it, in the beginning it will not be possible. When you get used to those pauses, you can feel the inner drive before the distraction even starts. And that drive to affirm existence, to affirm my being with yet another thought process, yet another sensory contact, this drive we relax. That is where Mahamudra practice really works. Yeah, that is the additional thing that I can offer to you. Okay. Come on. Only 9 minutes more than usual. Sunam de ye tam jazing pane tob ne ne pedranam pam jene kengana chim palam jum paye si pensu le jowa Jampem pavujitakyam padam kuntu sampudayam deshinte Deda kunji jesu dat lom ching ge wan di da tam che dam tu mu. Sangye kusum nye pe jen lam tan, che di min chu dam pe jen lam tan. Gendu mi che dam pe jen lam ji, ji tang o wa man lam jom pa shum.